There's a story from the time of the Buddha of a young 7-year-old monk who came to the monastery, and he was practicing under the guidance of Shariputra, one of the senior monks. And one day, I think it was the first day that this young monk was in the monastery, the next morning they went out for alms round together. Shariputra and this young monk went out for alms rounds together. And while they were walking along, the little boy saw, the young novice monk saw, an irrigation ditch on the side of the road with the water flowing along the irrigation ditch. And he asked what that was. And Shariputra told him it was an irrigation ditch. And the young boy said, "Does water have a mind?" And Shariputra said, "No." And the boy was kind of interested that the water could be guided even though it didn't have a mind. And they went a little further and they saw arrow makers making arrows and arrowheads. And again, the boy asked what it was, and Shariputra responded, and he said, "Well, does that stone that they're shaping have a mind?" Shariputra said, "No." And again, he was kind of marveling at the fact that something could be shaped that didn't have a mind. And they went further again and saw carpenters with their wood. Same kind of question, same kind of response. And the story goes that after that third witnessing of irrigators that could guide the water, the fletchers that could shape the arrows, and the carpenters that could shape wood, the 7-year-old monk had the, in some ways, the gall to say to Shariputra, "Please take your alms bowl back," because he had been carrying Shariputra's alms bowl for him. "I'm going to go back to the monastery to meditate." And the understanding of this story is that this young boy was so inspired by seeing that things that didn't have a mind could be shaped. He thought, how much more so can we shape a mind? So this prompted the Buddha to write a verse. And it actually, the story actually goes that this young monk, I don't know if he became fully enlightened, but he became very enlightened that very day, this 7-year-old boy. The Buddha wrote, "Irrigators guide water, fletchers shape arrows, carpenters fashion wood, sages tame themselves." So an important part of our meditation practice is shaping the mind. And this is the subject of the talk today, the third foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of mind. So learning how to observe the mind itself is the subject of this contemplation. The term used in the text, the Pali term used for mind here, is citta. And it has the connotation of the mind together, or let's say consciousness together with all of the associated feelings, flavors, intentions that kind of come together with it. So one of the terms is sometimes called concomitance. So consciousness together with all of its concomitant experiences. This is what citta refers to. So I'm going to read you this section. How does one abide contemplating mind as mind? One understands mind affected by lust as a mind affected by lust, and mind unaffected by lust as mind unaffected by lust. One understands mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. Likewise for delusion. One understands contracted mind as contracted mind, and distracted mind as distracted mind. And then the tone of the instruction shifts a little bit. In this first part, the instructions are looking at wholesome and unwholesome mind states. Lust, hatred, delusion, and their opposites. And then this notion of contracted and distracted. So this is in the territory of what we might think of as kind of normal or ordinary states of mind. And, you know, the kind of the unwholesome or the wholesome flavor of the mind. So getting familiar with the presence or absence of unwholesome qualities. That's kind of what this first part says. But then it shifts a little bit. And this next part looks more at the development of the mind. And the terms used here are a little odd for us. I'm just going to read it through first, and then I'll talk a little bit about this. One understands exalted mind as exalted mind, and unexalted mind as unexalted mind. One understands surpassed mind as surpassed mind, and unsurpassed mind as unsurpassed mind. One understands concentrated mind as concentrated mind, and unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated mind. One understands liberated mind as liberated mind, and unliberated mind as unliberated mind. So I want to just kind of go over, first just go over kind of the structure of this, talking a little bit about what it means in the overview of what this can, how this can be understood. The first part, as I said, can be understood as looking at the wholesome and unwholesome flavor of the mind, whether there's lust, hatred, delusion present in the mind, whether there's a sense of contraction of the mind, it's kind of being pulled inward, kind of stuck inside, or distracted, being kind of scattered and not able to focus on things. So this part of the instructions we can use in our exploration of emotions, as Gil was pointing to the other day. And I think it points to the kind of the way this is framed to me points to kind of simplifying how we look at our experience. So for instance, anger is a kind of a complex emotion. And if we look at how anger might be seen through this frame of reference, we may notice that there are threads of several of these aspects in anger. For instance, we might have kind of obviously noticed the kind of hatred or ill will aspect in the anger. We might notice a contraction in this state of anger. We might also notice some some greed or some wanting, some kind of sense of maybe the anger is around somebody having something that you want. So there may be a thread of greed in that anger as well. So in looking at our what happens in our minds, I think part of what the Buddha is pointing to with this instruction is that there's some specific things that are really worth highlighting in what your mind is doing. So this is like in terms of thinking about how to shape the mind, it's really useful to look at whether there is greed, aversion, or delusion in the mind, whether there is non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion in the mind. That this is a central consideration for us. And in terms of the path that we are on towards finding our way away from suffering, really helpful to notice, is greed present? Is greed absent? Is hatred present? Is hatred absent? Is delusion present? Is delusion absent? Contraction, distraction. So I see that what he's pointing to here is, you know, what are the most effective or most key points that we need to keep track of, what we need to pay attention to in our experience. Now, I do want to also say that in my own personal experience, I have found it extremely helpful to just simply recognize an emotion as an emotion. So noticing, oh, anger is present. Oh, this is anger. So I have also found that to be very helpful. So I don't want to discourage you from doing that. I'm just trying to point to, you know, the Buddha was pointing us to kind of simplifying in a way and looking in particular at some key places where we get caught. These are the areas that directly lead us to suffering. So that's one aspect of this teaching. Another that I think is, it's kind of interesting to highlight this, the kind of phraseology of the text was perhaps a little odd. It said, you know, one notices the mind filled with hate as the mind filled with hate. The one notices a contracted mind as a contracted mind, etc. It kind of repeated itself. And what is that saying? What is that pointing to? What it seems to be pointing to is that this, what this is instructing us to do is to be aware, mindful in a non-reactive way to our states of mind. It's not suggesting, well, first of all, it doesn't say one notices a mind filled with hate and then one beats oneself up about it. It says one notices a mind filled with hate as a mind filled with hate. So it's pointing to this non-reactive attention. It's not even recommending in this instruction as taking any active measures to oppose the state. It's recommending mindfulness as the medicine. So I think we need to be aware in our own experience. And this is kind of one way that we do encourage you to pay attention to your experience. You know, if you notice you've got a strong emotion, can you be with it? Can you turn towards it? And we offer, you know, going to the other foundations, come into the body, see if that helps you to be non-reactive to it. Notice the feeling tone, see if that helps you to be non-reactive with it. This is pointing directly to the state of mind itself. Can you be with this state of mind? If you can be with it in a non-reactive way, that itself allows the state to kind of live its natural life without being additionally fed, additionally conditioned. I think that a lot of us have some kind of a fear or a sense that if I turn my attention to hatred in my experience, that will just make it get stronger. There's a certain kind of way we can attend to hatred that does make it stronger. It's a way of feeding it with thinking about it, thinking thoughts about it, kind of a fueling of it. But there is a kind of a non-reactive mindful attention that simply allows it to be, and it doesn't exacerbate it. It allows it to let go on its own. So in a sense, mindfulness brings the balance to keep us unentangled from these states. Another point or piece that I think is helpful to recognize in this teaching is that he talks about noticing presence and absence of these unwholesome mind states. Notice when lust is present. Notice when greed is present. Notice when the mind does not have greed in it. This one practice, notice the presence and absence of difficult states of mind, I have found to be immensely helpful. Especially for patterns of thought or patterns of mind that are really habitual. Ones that we, deeply identify with. We kind of feel like, yep, that's me. I know that feeling. I'm the miserable person. I'm the lonely person. I'm the angry person. We kind of, without being aware of it, we kind of feel like that pattern is always somehow there. And that it just sometimes becomes obvious to us. But it becomes obvious to us so much that we think it's always there. And so that identification adds a kind of solidity to that experience. Yes, I'm the miserable person. I'm always miserable. I've always been miserable. I'll always be miserable. Well, yeah, I'm happy right now, but I know really what I am is miserable. So, taking in when miserable is absent, actually taking it in, very, very helpful. It begins to poke holes in that identity. In that sense that, yes, I'm always this way. Consciously recognizing the absence of these habits of mind. Very helpful. So the second part of the instructions, and I'm not going to go into this part in much detail, I just kind of want to give an overview, the second part where it talks about the terms were something like exalted and unexalted, surpassed and unsurpassed, and concentrated, not concentrated, liberated and not liberated. And looking at the descriptions of these, I found some definitions of these terms, but there wasn't a lot of consensus as to what they actually meant. And there were different opinions about whether they were referring to complete liberation, like unsurpassed. Does that mean complete liberation, or does it mean the fourth jhana, or or does it mean the states of jhana where the body disappears? So there was just all this discussion about the various ways what these terms could mean. But they did seem to be in agreement that they relate to various aspects of concentration and various depths of concentration. So various levels of the deepening of concentration. So for instance, the the quality of surpassed and unsurpassed. Some commentators have made the point that the unsurpassed state of mind is the one which has no more disturbance in it. And surpassable state of mind is a state of mind where there's still some disturbance. So there's a way that we can recognize our state of mind and know, is there still some disturbance here? You know, even as we're settling in concentration, is there still some disturbance? Is there something that can be released even here in this state of concentration? So this state of mind can be surpassed. It's kind of what that's pointing to. So I think taken as a whole, these various aspects, this second half, is pointing to a couple of pieces. One, it's encouraging us to track and recognize the deepening of our mental, our meditative states. So to actually recognize the mind is becoming concentrated. The mind is not concentrated. Or in a state of concentration. How deep is the concentration? So to be aware of that, to kind of track the progress or the development of the mind through meditation. Essentially turning the attention towards the meditation itself as something to pay attention to. The state of mind constructed in meditation as an object. That's kind of what it's pointing to. One way that this third foundation of mindfulness can be also understood is it's related in a way to what I was just talking about, turning the attention towards the state of mind that is meditating, and that is related to what Gil mentioned in the instructions. I think it was a couple of mornings ago, the looking at the quality of the mind that is paying attention. So we're paying attention to our knee pain, that the mind is attending to bodily experience, it's attending to burning, stabbing, pulsing, vibrating. If we're not somehow also aware that there may be a kind of coloration in the mind, kind of not liking, wanting it to go away, then we may be unwittingly cultivating that not liking. Because it's kind of like a lens. We have these lenses, or we're seeing through. We're looking at our experience through some perspective. We're looking at our experience through a perspective of, I don't like this. And we're not aware of that perspective, then we're cultivating that perspective. We're practicing that perspective. So this foundation of this third foundation of mindfulness can also be understood as exploring this quality of the mind that pays attention, turning our attention from time to time to how we are relating to our experience. One of my teachers, Saito Utejaniya, has a title of a book called Awareness Alone is Not Enough. And by that he means that we can be aware of things, we can be aware of our knee pain, we can be aware of the sensations of our body, we can be aware of the taste of our food, but if we are not aware of the kind of attitudes of mind behind what we're paying attention to, then we're just going to stay stuck in our same old patterns. So uncovering the relationship of our mind to what we are experiencing is very powerful. So ways to do this, how do we do this? You know, from time to time checking in, asking, almost asking a question, you know, so what is my relationship to my experience? Knowing what you're paying attention to, and then asking the question, and how am I relating to that? Utejaniya calls this attitude. That's a term. I'll probably use that term almost out of habit, because I've practiced with him so much. That's the term I think of when I think of this exploration, looking at the attitude of my mind as I'm paying attention. It's referring to this how. How am I paying attention? What's my relationship to my experience? From time to time, checking in about this. Now, it's not so helpful to do this frequently. You know, I think Gil the other day said, you know, it's up for you to determine the kind of how often to check into this. I found, you know, if you do it frequently, then it kind of becomes this craziness, you know, kind of like, oh, what's my attitude? What's my attitude? What's my attitude? What's my attitude? And it's not so helpful. But, you know, from time to time, you know, check in when you're feeling a sense of struggle. That's a good time to check in. You know, check in after you've come back from your mind wandering. Sometimes that's a good time to check in. What's my relationship to the fact that my mind has been wandering? Check in when it's going really well. What's your relationship to that? Just from time to time. When you check in, it's likely that you'll see, if you ask this question, you know, it's likely that you'll see basically, you know, one of these flavors of mind that the Buddha pointed to in this third foundation. I'll categorize them in roughly four camps here for now. You'll notice that you like some, you want something. You there's a kind of an attitude of greed about the experience. You'll find you don't like it. So there's an attitude of not liking the experience. There's a kind of confusion or disconnect, kind of a not sure kind of experience, delusion. And then there can be a balance of mind. So that, you know, roughly covers those first, that first set of mind states that the Buddha talked about. Noticing presence or absence of greed, presence or absence of aversion, presence or absence of delusion. So roughly when you check in, you'll notice one of these kinds of states. Now, you know, it can be pretty subtle sometimes. You know, for instance, the wanting, the greed. It can be really obvious. You know, you might notice you see the cookies at the end of the counter. And so you see the cookies and you notice they're seen, but you also immediately notice that, ooh, yeah, better get down there quick. You know, want one of those cookies. Or maybe this morning you were seeing, oh, there's only a few left. I better take some now. You know, so the sometimes it can be really obvious that there's that greed in the mind. It can also get a little more subtle. You know, it might be a kind of expectation in the meditation. Ooh, what's going to happen next? Or maybe excitement as a kind of a greed. You know, it's something delightful has happened, and because of that delight, there's this, oh, look at this, isn't it? And we kind of get a little bit excited. Or there might be amusement. Amusement is a very kind of subtle form of greed in a way. it can get even subtler, just a subtle leaning in, you know. Just, you might notice from time to time in the breath, you know, you're right with the breath, and then at the end of the in-breath, there's just a subtle leaning. And the out-breath, and the out-breath, where's the out-breath? Just a kind of leaning forward into the experience. So this checking in to this, how am I relating to experience, can begin to uncover some really quiet forms of these states. Likewise with the aversion, again, there can be some really obvious forms: anger, hatred, dislike, frustration, annoyance, irritation. These kinds of flavors of this aversive mind can be clear. Slightly more subtle might be a sense of just discontent, or could be better. Things could be better. Just kind of just subtly off. Or perhaps even, I know many of you know this one, by paying attention just right to this unpleasant experience, it will go away. A subtle form of aversion. So, you know, just checking in. Are there some agendas in our meditation? Is there an in order to? So this attitude, checking into the relationship, can reveal, I'm paying attention in order to. So some kind of an agenda that has a flavor of either wanting or not wanting. Delusion I'm going to talk about in a little bit more detail. So I'm going to hold that one aside for a moment. Then there is balance of mind. There is the place where we check our relationship to experience and we basically feel like calm, peaceful, easeful. Sometimes when we check in to what's my relationship to experience, people say, well, I check in and I'm not seeing anything. There's no attitude. Sometimes that means that you're not quite attuned to just the subtle form of ease or peace. And it also might mean that there's a subtler form of greed or aversion that you're not quite attuned to. So what I usually suggest for people is if they check in and say, well, there's no particular attitude, first try on to say, well, is it ease or is it peace? You know, is it one of these more subtle kinds of basic balance of mind? And if it's not, I mean, if you can't identify anything, don't worry about it. Just simply go back to noticing what you are aware of. Just notice the pain in your knee, or notice the pressure, or notice the pleasant or unpleasant. Just notice what you're noticing. So don't worry about it if, in checking in from time to time, if nothing is obvious. There's no, it's not helpful to try to dig or figure out or think it through. This is kind of check in, perhaps ask the question, and then if there's an obvious answer, that's great. And then you can include that within the field of what you pay attention to. Then it's no longer obscured. It's no longer kind of below the horizon of our subconscious. It's brought into the field of awareness, and it no longer has the capacity to kind of influence our mind without our awareness of it. So it diminishes the power of these attitudes to simply recognize that they're operating. And this is what the instruction is in the third foundation. So you see, oh, there's wanting in the mind. This is a mind affected by wanting. So it's that simple in terms of the instruction to look back at this mind state, become aware of it, and allow it to be conscious, allow it to be known. So delusion. Sometimes people, I get the question, well, so yeah, I understand greed and aversion. Those are pretty, they seem pretty clear at times. You know, they've got kind of a visceral feeling to them. But how do I notice delusion? How on earth can I notice delusion? What does that even mean? So I'd like to explore a little bit about delusion, ways that it appears, ways that it manifests, essentially ways that it masks experience or hides experience. Because some familiarity with the ways that delusion works can help us to see it operating. So I'm going to cover three basic aspects. One is a kind of a not knowing, that delusion can be a simply kind of an unconnectedness, a not knowing, an unawareness, an uncertainty. That can be one flavor of delusion. Another flavor of delusion is denial. And another flavor of delusion, I think kind of the most basic, is distortion of how we see the world. So that there's some fundamental ways that we mistake reality. Some kind of skewed views that we have that lead us to misperceive experience. So the first one, this not knowing, it's kind of, you know, just a non-connectedness. This is maybe kind of a spacing out. You all have that sense of spacing out at times. That kind of takes us into a cloud of delusion. It feels like just a haze, in the space of dullness. Kind of this, it's referring in a way to the state of contraction that the third foundation refers to, just kind of in and stuck inwardly. They're just not connecting to experience. We might be lost in thought in a kind of a world, a bubble of memory. It's kind of startling at times that, you know, that sometimes when our mindfulness gets clear, we can actually see those bubbles of memory burst. And in an instant of seeing that bubble of memory burst, see how deeply we believed in the previous moment that we were in that world, that we were acting and moving in that memory or in that fantasy. Sometimes when the mindfulness is clear, it can see it vanish, and it's like, where am I? You know, just a second ago, I was back with that person over in that place, and here I am now. So we can see that we were living in that delusion. So there are different ways that this not connecting manifests. Another way is the kind of the scatteredness, where we can't connect with anything in particular. This, you know, the contraction inwardly and the scattered externally, those two states that the third foundation mentions. When we're scattered, we're not connecting with anything in particular. The mind is kind of not touching on anything. It's trying to touch on too many things. So again, that's a not connecting. So this is a way that delusion operates, by keeping us disconnected from experience. Then there's denial. And often, a kind of our usual definition of denial is something along the lines of, or the most common understanding is something like, if I ignore it, it will go away. You know, that kind of sense around denial. It's a form, in a way, of not wanting to see the truth. Often, it has a flavor of either greed or aversion to it. This kind of familiar denial that we're familiar with. This kind of denial that we're familiar with. So, for example, there's the, you know, proverbial elephant in the room. You know, that everybody knows this situation is there, but nobody talks about it because of fear, because of, you know, afraid that somebody is going to explode if that elephant is mentioned. So that's a kind of a denial, but it is kind of got some aversion to it. So it's I wouldn't call that a pure delusion, because there's a lot of aversion there. It's kind of like the aversion is kind of the main thing that's keeping us disconnected. Could be motivated by greed. You know, the classic belief at the beginning of, you know, the romantic love, you know, the somehow that place of romantic love creates this delusion in our minds that this is going to last forever. So again, that's motivated by a kind of a wanting. But there are, I think, some kind of more pure forms of denial that have to do with the way views are created, that we live in worlds of views that may or may not be true. And the views that we hold, you know, they may not particularly have to do with greed or aversion. It's just the view. We may have this view that because, you know, we've been told something repeatedly. We have a view that, you know, just in our culture, for example, you know, we are told repeatedly that something along the lines of, and it's not even, you know, directly in words, but somehow we get this belief, this view that anybody who works hard enough can get what they want in our culture. And, you know, so this belief leads us to look at our world in a certain way. And, you know, in terms of delusion, somebody who's living in this world and gets what they want can just be immune or kind of unaware of the kind of privilege they may be, that they may have. This is classic white privilege in our culture. The unawareness that this myth, that if you work hard enough, is founded on a lot of delusion. So, you know, in a particular person holding this belief, it may not be founded on greed or aversion particularly. It's simply what you've been told over and over and over and over again. So views can be created based on being told something repeatedly. Views can be created out of misunderstanding information. So, you know, one example of this that I have come up with is when I was a kid, I was in an art class, and this teacher, at one point we were drawing apples, and some of us would draw our apples kind of lopsided, and she'd come around and make us erase those and redraw them. She said, "All apples are symmetrical." And, you know, we thought, we've surely seen lopsided apples. You know. But she made us redraw them. They had to be perfect, you know, perfectly shaped. And, you know, we talked about this as kids. You know, one of the little boys in the class brought a really lopsided apple in one day, put it on her desk. And, you know, she didn't say a word, you know. It's like, you know, it just completely went by her. And, you know, this stuck in my mind all these years. And one day, you know, thinking about delusion and, you know, what is delusion? I was just kind of reflecting on it. And I was cutting an apple in my kitchen, reflecting on delusion. And I was cutting the apple along a line of symmetry. Apples roughly grow symmetrically. You can cut an apple in half, and the two halves are kind of mirror images of each other. And in that moment, I thought, oh, maybe that art teacher misunderstood the term symmetry. And she thought it meant perfectly shaped. You know, she maybe had been in some botany class somewhere where the teacher says, you know, the growth of natural things is symmetrical. And she misunderstood what that meant. Now, I don't know if that's really what happened, but it occurred to me that that is a way that delusion can be formed. We misunderstand information. Views can be informed out of misunderstanding. And, you know, one of the scary things about views, and this relates to all the views I'm speaking about here, is that when we hold a view that deeply, we cannot see evidence to the contrary. Putting that apple on her desk, I think it just didn't even enter her mind. Another way that views can be formed is out of our own direct experience. one example of this that created great suffering. Our direct experience shows us every single day, or, you know, the feeling of our direct experience every single day points to we're standing still and the sun is going around us. The sun is moving through the sky every day. The earth is the center of the heavens. Our direct experience confirms that over and over again. It's kind of hard to not, you know, if you don't have another, if you don't have a shift of perspective, it's kind of hard to come up with the idea that we're actually hurtling through space at an incredible speed and we're spinning around rapidly and that's what makes it look like the sun is rising. Who would think that? People died for expressing a contrary view to that belief. It was heresy to express that. Well, what if the earth goes around the sun? So views can be formed in many ways. So this is a place where it's really in looking at our experience, can we look at what we believe? You know, sometimes we can pick up on these beliefs. Sometimes the beliefs are hard to see. It's like it's the water we're swimming in. They're hard to see. But just beginning to notice, and we can begin to notice through our meditation when we see something, our relationship to that. Often these attitudes of mind come out of some kind of belief. So this can begin to unveil or uncover some of these beliefs that we hold, some of these views that are formed. And then there are some even more fundamental kinds of misperceptions, kind of distortions of the way we see things. The ones I've been talking about, these views that are formed, they may be cultural, they may be personal, they may come just in our own way we live, what we've learned, who we've met. But there's some other kinds of distortion of perception that seem to be more fundamentally human, that we all share these distortions. And these are that we often take what is impermanent to be permanent. We take what is actually suffering to be a source of happiness. We take what is not self to be self. And we take what is unbeautiful to be beautiful. So just briefly going through these, seeing the impermanent as permanent. I mean, kind of the most, there's ways that we know things are impermanent. I mean, you know, we all know things are impermanent. But this taking, this distortion of perception is that even though we know things are impermanent, somehow we don't act that way. That, you know, our operating mode is, for many of us, the notion of our mortality, while a concept, isn't something we really connect with. Until there's a clear wake-up signal, often we just live our lives as if we were immortal. And this moves down too into even, you know, simple things, the way we, you know, we all sitting here kind of envision that we have our homes to go back to. You know, who knows what's happened? There was one meditation teacher who returned and found her home burned to the ground. So, you know, there's a kind of assumption that we make around permanence. So look deeply in your experience. What is it that you are assuming to be permanent? Look at what you think is solid or stable. Begin looking at that, and you will quickly see it changes. This begins to kind of undermine this belief in permanence. Seeing what is suffering to be happiness. You know, the classic understanding of this is that we believe that if we get what we want, we'll be happy. You know, that having something is what will make us happy. And so there's a kind of this is related in a sense to that permanence sense, that even just for a split second, you know, we have this bit of chocolate. You know, we know that that bit of chocolate isn't ultimately going to make us happy forever, but while we're having it, you know, there's a kind of belief, yeah, this is what it's supposed to be like. And this is happiness. This, and that, you know, we place our happiness on things that are inherently unreliable. So, you know, intimately connected with this truth of impermanence is this truth of unreliability. That no matter what we try to put our happiness on, it is impermanent. So it's unreliable. So we may get moments of happiness. We may feel happy for those few seconds or even for a few minutes or hours, or but it will end. It will change. Seeing what is not self to be self. And this is really deep in us. I'm not going to try to convince you of anything here. But I will ask you to explore in your experience, what is it that you think of as self? Right now, in your experience, what is it that you are taking to be I, me, or mine? Look at that. Observe that. If you continually look at what you take to be self, you'll find that it's actually a whole series of different processes. There's some familiar ones that run through now and then. Oh yeah, this miserable one, I recognize that one. But there's not a stability. It's basically process. What we take to be self is a set of processes. So look at what you think of as self. Just turn and reflect, turn and explore that. This is the deepest of our delusions. Then seeing what is unbeautiful as beautiful. The classic description of this is around our body, you know, that we kind of look at our bodies as beautiful or other bodies as beautiful. And you know, this isn't pointing, you know, that this is a kind of hard one for us Westerners, because we have such, you know, negative, we hold such judgmental attitudes about our own bodies, that as a corrective for that, it's helpful to think of our, you know, all bodies are beautiful, everything's okay, you know, so kind of as a corrective for our mentality. So I want to put this out there in a kind of a gentle way. But the classic understanding here is that, you know, typically we see, we're not seeing the whole picture when we see something as beautiful. Essentially, we're only seeing a certain side of it, so we're missing a part of it. So we're not seeing, you know, when we see the beauty of a young, healthy person, you know, inherent in that young, healthy person is that they will grow old and age and get sick. And, you know, that person, you know, 50 years from now, we wouldn't necessarily think of as beautiful anymore, physically beautiful. Another way to look at this is one way that Joseph Goldstein talks about it. He says, you know, when we think about unpeeling the body, you know, start looking at the organs inside, you know, take the skin off of our body, it's not as beautiful looking. You know, you break a bone and it starts jetting through your skin. You know, most people have a sense of revulsion when they see that kind of thing. So one way to reflect on this, that Heather Martin brought out, I like this way, one way of reflecting on this is that the parts that we consider beautiful of our bodies, you know, we look at skin, that's beautiful, and hair, and nails, they're all the dead bits already. You know, it's just the flaking off of the skin, the hair, you know, it's, you know, you can cut it. It doesn't even hurt to cut the hair. So, just a reflection. One of the key ways to uncovering delusion is to look at where they're suffering. Where they're suffering, there's some kind of delusion operating. Suffering is actually our guide. You know, we observing the presence and absence of these qualities that I've been talking about, observing the presence and absence of greed, aversion, delusion, begins to point us to the states of mind that lead us towards happiness or lead us towards suffering. Greed, aversion, delusion are understood to be the roots of those states that lead us to suffering. We also begin to see, as we observe this, the causes and conditions that lead us to grasp after things that are pleasant and want to push things away that are unpleasant. We start seeing the causal relationships. So in a way, you know, this whole reflection kind of comes back to the simplicity of noticing suffering, the absence of suffering, noticing the cause of suffering, or the things that support not suffering. This is really, it points us in this direction of contemplating experience through this framework of suffering. Suffering really is our guide. It leads us. Wherever there's suffering, there's something to understand. We can understand our delusion through suffering. This checking in the mind state, how am I relating to experience, begins to uncover subtler and subtler forms of this of these roots of greed, aversion, and delusion. Subtler and subtler ways that we find ourselves moving into suffering. And this points to, and I'm just going to close with this because we aren't really getting a chance to talk about the fourth foundation in detail, but the contemplation of the Four Noble Truths is the last contemplation in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And to me, it kind of just encapsulates the entire thing. In its very simplicity, all that we need to do is notice, is this suffering? What are the causes of this suffering? What are the steps that will lead me out of this suffering? Any moment of our experience, we can see through this framework. I'm suffering. There's suffering present. Suffering is not present. the causes of suffering are present, or the causes that will lead me away from suffering are present. So I think all of the foundations of mindfulness lead us to be able to contemplate things in this way. It takes some skill. But again, I think that the Buddha is pointing us to simplify. You know, the simplicity of just using suffering as our guide. Using dissatisfaction, stress, as our guide. It's not a mistake. It actually will lead us, if we are able to turn towards it and meet it without reactivity, with that balanced non-reactive mind, the suffering will guide us towards freedom from suffering. Thank you for your attention.